Hello and welcome to Inside Exercise. I'm Emeritus Professor Glenn McConnell from Victoria University in Australia. The idea behind Inside Exercise is to bring to you the absolute who's who of exercise research, so exercise physiology, exercise metabolism, and exercise and health. And what I'm really wanting is for you to get your exercise information from the research experts rather than from influencers. And indeed, today I bring to you Assistant Professor Kevin Morak from the University of Arkansas in the USA. Kevin is a rising star in muscle research. So he looks at muscle mass, what regulates muscle mass, how resistance training increases muscle mass. And also we talked today about muscle memory. So the fact that if you do exercise training and then you have a period of time where you don't exercise and then you exercise again, it appears that the muscle responds quicker the second time. So there's been some sort of muscle memory. So we talk about what is the evidence for muscle memory and how is it regulated? So at the muscle level, is it genetics? Is it epigenetics? As it changes within the muscles, gene expression, et cetera. I found him a really fun guy to chat with. He's really on top of his field. I learned a lot. I think you will too. So stick around. If you'd like to do me a favor and also help spread the word about Inside Exercise, please like, comment, subscribe, et cetera, because then it makes it more likely if someone does a search about exercise that the algorithm will suggest Inside Exercise. Now, with all the podcasts, it's much better if you watch the whole podcast to get the full context. But if you'd like to jump around a little bit, for example, if we're talking about mechanisms and you'd rather skip over that, then you can look down at the notes and you can see the timestamps are there. So it shows at each time what we're talking about, so you can skip around a little bit. Okay, so enjoy the chat. Hi, Kevin. How are you doing? Welcome to Inside Exercise. Thanks for coming on.
Thanks for having me. I'm very excited. I appreciate the invite.
Oh, no. Yeah, I'm really happy to have you on. You're the second official sort of rising star. You've got an amazing track record for how long you've been around. We'll talk about that. So the first one was the great Carlos Olguin from University of Copenhagen, who I met a couple of times. I was out there, so that was great. So people can look that up. But so we're going to talk about epigenetics. So we'll explain what that is and muscle memory and things like that. What I like to do at the start is just sort of talk about how did you actually get in to exercise research to start with?
Yeah, I mean, I was like many other people on this podcast, was an athlete. No, I personally wasn't a very talented one, but I played sports in college or in high school, not in college. I wasn't even that good. I played sports in high school, tennis, soccer, and I got into weightlifting. Then went off to college and, you know, continued kind of just exercising for the sake of exercising. I enjoyed it. I specifically enjoyed lifting weights. So I kind of, all my research reflects back on that. Like I view everything through the lens of like, you know, weightlifting. But I really enjoyed that aspect of exercising. And so in college, you know, started lifting weights more and start thinking more about, you know, how do my muscles grow? Like, how does this process happen? Just kind of became more of a personal interest. But it was around that time I realized I could study exercise science as like a profession or as a major at that time, but I didn't realize it could become a profession. So studied exercise science at UNC, Chapel Hill in North Carolina. And then, once I got that degree, I didn't really, you know what to do with it. And so I decided to get a master's degree in exercise physiology. And that was at James Madison University. I worked with a guy named Nick Luden, who had just graduated with his PhD from Ball State University. And so he toured James Madison. He said, you know, you should go to Ball State. That's where I went. I think you'd like it. So I, went and got my PhD at Ball State University. And, you know, at this point I had, you know, started doing some different types of exercise, started riding the bike a little more, road bike, things like that. So I was training concurrently, so to say. But again, this interest in personal interest in exercise sort of evolved into more of an academic interest at this point, you know, doing, as you know, muscle biopsy work and single muscle fiber physiology, fiber typing, things like that. And after I graduated from the HPL at Ball State, I went and did a 6-year postdoc with Dr. Charlotte Peterson and Dr. John McCarthy. So did a lot of more preclinical work, you know, looking with mice, doing a lot of cells, genetically modified mouse models, really focused on muscle stem cells, satellite cells, primarily. Yep. And it was around that time I started kind of thinking more about epigenetics and aging and skeletal muscle with exercise as well. So I started transitioning towards the end of that time into those areas, which is what I study now in my my own laboratory at University of Arkansas. So that's kind of like my my academic story arc, but it began with a personal interest and just kind of evolved into I can study muscle adaptation for a living. That's amazing. So I just kind of kept down that.
And you've been doing amazingly well. So I don't know, looking at Google Scholar, it looked like your first citations were sort of 2015 or something. Is that right?
Yeah, that sounds right. Yeah.
Yeah.
About
And
nine years ago.
When did you get your PhD?
I finished in 2015. Yep.
Yeah, so about that. So that's amazing because you've got an H. I don't know if people know what an H index is. I've mentioned it here and there, but an H index is the number of times you've been cited per paper. So if you have an H index of one, you've got like one paper that's been cited once. You might have three papers, but you've had, you know, one citation for one paper. An H index of 20 is you've got like 20 papers that have been cited 20 times or more. You might have 40 papers. You've got an H index on Google Scholar anyway, which is slightly more generous than Web of Science, of 31 already. And you said something like, how many papers did you say you got during your postdoc?
You know, I think it was between, I want to say it was between 35 and 40. I don't know the exact number, but it was in that range. We were very productive at the University of Kentucky.
Wow.
And it was just me, of course. Like, couldn't have been. Yeah, I think,
that's
I don't
amazing.
Know how many first author, but there was a lot of collaboration going on, and so it was a very, very rich environment for productivity.
So you're doing great. So as I said, second rising, I'd call officially a rising star. And you said you just got a new investigator award. What was that one?
From the American Physiological Society for the like cell and molecular physiology section. So a couple of nice folks nominated me, and so that's cool. So I'll be at that conference in whenever it is. When is that conference? It's in April. So I'm going to go to that.
Okay, great. All right. So we're going to talk about epigenetics and muscle memory. So maybe we'll just talk a little bit about what epigenetics is in a little bit. But if we just talk about this muscle memory concept, so it sort of gets, you know, banded around a little bit. I guess lay people sort of, you know, it's almost like saying, oh, I'm, you know, running to the bus and my legs are burning. It's the lactate. You know, it's like, maybe not, you know. But so what is muscle memory, and when people talk about that, and I guess it's a bit of a controversial term, and
sure. Well, I think it controversial and or has multiple meanings to different people. It's probably both of those things. A lot of people think when they say muscle memory, they take, I think, probably the most, you know, immediate examples, like riding a bike. They think, you know, oh, it's muscle memory because that's how I know how to ride a bike, even though I haven't ridden one in 20 years. And that's one possible kind of explanation or interpretation of what that means. That probably more related to like, you know, neuromuscular or neural patterning, things like that. That's more probably in the brain and spinal cord. When I think about muscle memory, I'm thinking more in like the muscle cell. So like in the muscle fibers themselves, and basically changes, long-term changes that could potentially be happening in the muscle in response to a stimulus that make it perhaps more adaptive in the future based on what it was exposed to. So I think of it more as like a cellular phenomenon, so to say, and maybe not so much. There could be a neural component to it as well, but I study more the muscle cellular component of what muscle memory is. And I think like colloquially in the field, and when we say the term muscle memory as muscle biologists, we're saying like, maybe you resistance trained once upon a time, then you stop resistance training for whatever reason, injury, COVID, whatever happens, you know, and then you start training again, that you're more sensitive to that training and you adapt again to that training more quickly. So, you know, what maybe took you 8 weeks to gain muscle mass the first time, maybe it only takes you 4 the next time. And that's the quote unquote muscle memory. So I think that's sort of the way that I think about it.
And that makes sense. Now, I guess I start to think now, I know you've said you've done, we tend to say preclinical, so sort of, you know, mice studies, rat studies, et cetera. And I know you've mainly done that. I just wonder, before we get into the nitty gritty of what you've done, because that's really interesting, I think it sounds pretty convincing. I'm just wondering, has that really been looked at? Have people, you know, sort of looked at that very closely with humans, just this concept of, because as you say, it does feel like, you know, if you've done weight training before and you do it again, it's like, oh, I'm taking this better than I did the first time. But you sort of wonder, how much of that is just sort of maybe confidence, because you sort of know what you're doing and all that. And like you said, and I like the fact you mentioned that, like, you know, you get on a bike 20 years later and you still know how to do it. That's not really the muscle, is it? It's sort of the motor learning, the sort of coordinating the, and even again, it could be confidence, right? When you start to learn to ride a bike, you're totally scared, right? You're going to fall over, you're crashing, you're dirt on the grass. The second time, you're more confident. So I guess How much is that, have that has been sort of looked at in humans, do you know?
Yeah, no, there has been some. It's not like a rich literature at this point, I would say, but it is a topic that is interesting to some muscle biologists, and it has been studied in a couple different contexts in humans. You know, there was a study early on by Milena Lindholm, that's her name, yeah, and CJ Sundberg, who's at Karolinska, where they did a study where they had people, human beings, come in and endurance train, and then looked at the detraining response and saw if there was long-term changes in gene expression and whether that could lead to, you know, a more adaptive response to retraining in the endurance training kind of realm. But I think in the resistance training realm, which is sort of where I reside, a guy named Adam Sharples, who is University mm-hmm. of Auburn now, he hasn't been on the podcast, I don't think.
His name's definitely been on the radar. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. I would say reach out to him. He'd be great. But yeah, he did a study in the year, it must have been in 15, 17, in that range. So not even that long ago, where they did a study where they had people come in resistance train. They would take biopsies before and after the training, then they detrained them for a period of time and took biopsies, and then retrained them and took biopsies again. It was a really involved mm-hmm. study, but they were probably one of the first ones in humans, I believe the first ones in humans with resistance training, to show that, yeah, there is this sort of accelerated rebound response. So if you had trained before and then you had gone back to your detrained state after training, so you had lost your hypertrophy in your muscle strength, that once you start training again, it came back more quickly. And they did show that using some different methods of looking at muscle size. And since that time, there's been a couple other studies in the resistance training realm that have supported that too, but it's not like a massive body of literature at this point. You know, it's more mm-hmm. kind of, as you say, like there was this anecdotal observation amongst people that go to the gym, and then, you know, just start asking the question and doing real experiments to kind of tease it out a little more. But there is evidence for it. It's just not a ton of it at the moment, because they're hard studies to do, right? As you know, like a training study is hard to pull off, and then you throw in detraining and retraining. Those are tough stuff.
The same people and hoping they don't drop out and things like that. Guess I was thinking, it sounds like it hasn't been done, but I guess I was thinking, because you're thinking mechanistic, and I like that. I always think mechanistic. But I was just thinking, if they'd, you know, looked at 10,000 people and asked them, you know, if you've done training and not, you know, without the mechanisms and all that stuff, sounds like no one's really done that.
I wouldn't think so. Kind of epidemiological study, so to say.
Even just getting a bunch of people and just saying, do you have your record? So for example, it's more with endurance training, but you know, Strava, you know, Strava?
I don't have it, but I know it.
Oh, okay. So I'm more like a cyclist type guy. So, and I always get injured. I've broken so many bones. So I mainly ride indoors, and I've got all the Strava data and all that. And they've started actually going back and looking at Strava data to see, people that, I don't know, ran 20 years ago, are they better now? Or, you know, so you could actually do that, I guess, if with endurance, you could see if people's running times, you know, that had 10 years off, and, you know, how quickly they got better and things like that. I guess I'm wondering about that, but it's also, I always think about endurance. So we'll get to endurance later as well. But yeah, it sounds, and when you talk about your mice data as well, it sounds definitely that there's something going on there. So let's talk about that. So why don't we just talk a bit without getting too mechanistic, because I want to just sort of talk about, and then we'll get into the epigenetics and is it, you know, myonuclear junctions and satellite cells and all that later. If you just talk about what you've done in the mice and what you found, and also, I guess, I'll be of interest how long that detraining is, you know, so sure. In the sharp, the study you spoke about in humans and also in your mice studies. Yep.
Yeah. Okay. So with the mice, I mean, I guess question or hurdle number one with doing a mouse study with exercise is getting a mouse to exercise, right? Of course, that's, you have to have a model for that. And rats are a little bit more conducive to training what I would call translatable way. You know, maybe some sort of weightlifting or running wheel or something to that effect. But mice are a little trickier. So our first challenge, yeah, they don't like to learn things, really. Mm-hmm. There's not a lot of operant condition going on with mice. And so, okay. So we ended up developing a new mouse model for exercise training, and we called it progressive weighted wheel running, POWER for short. And Corey Dungan, one of my postdoc colleagues, was really the one that kind of first put the mice on the wheels and tested this out. And then we adopted it as a laboratory at Kentucky. And but basically, it's, make a long story short, we put magnetic weights on the wheels in a very specific way so that they sort of have to resistance train while running. So it's voluntary for them. But we found that when we trained mice this way, you know, we just gave them these wheels with the special weighting, that they really took to it well, and they kind of became what I call athlete mice. You know, we measured their heart function, their hearts got a lot bigger, kind of an athlete's heart. Bigger left ventricle sort of thing. Mm-hmm. But also their muscles got a lot bigger, their hind limb muscles specifically. So that was the first thing. So it's like, okay, now we have our training model. That's good.
Just to interject on that. So that's interesting. Yeah. Cause when I first saw in your paper about this, sort of resisted, running wheel, it's pretty interesting because you don't normally think of that. So it's almost concurrent training. Yeah. So they're doing, when they're running, it's hard. So it's like, because it's hard to imagine a human, you'd have to run up a treadmill that's so steep to actually get hypertrophy as well as, you know, endurance responses.
And that is a method that some people use, is uphill high intensity treadmill running. There are some groups that do that. And that is one way to do it. But we like our real running. It's voluntary. It's not forced. Yes. Both have advantages and disadvantages. Like, you have more control with the running, and, you know,
I think it's a great model. Yeah. The voluntary wheel running is, and the fact they do it, they choose to do it as well. And they do it enough to get, actually, you're saying, cardiovascular responses, so sort of endurance type responses, and they get hypertrophy. Yeah.
Most certainly. Yeah. Their muscles get bigger and their hearts get bigger. And mouse fiber types are an interesting conversation as far as do they become more oxidative, these different things. But yes, it seems like there's a fiber type switch in a kind of a slower direction. The type of things you'd expect to see if you train. But yeah, it is this kind of combination sort of concurrent approach where,
I just interject again? Can I ask, because I know people have done, because I never forget seeing this picture in a journal article where they got rats to do squats. Have you seen that?
Yeah, exactly.
So they got them to sort of stand up, and they had this weight, and they had to get down to eat, and then they had to lift up or something. And maybe you can explain that a bit. But I was wondering why, because you're interested mainly in strength, why did you not go with something that was more strength rather than concurrent? I'm just wondering about that.
Sure. Well, at the time, this was when I was postdoc, so this was, you know, between 2009 and 2015. So at that time, there wasn't, other than like what we call synergist ablation, which is a surgical model and for studying muscle growth, and that has advantages and disadvantages too. But there wasn't really anything out there that was really, other than like electrical stimulation of the muscle of the mice, where you have to like anesthetize them and do all these things. So the wheel running it just made sense because we had running wheels
and it's voluntary.
It was a little bit of a convenience thing, but at the same time, it ended up working out better than we would have expected. But since that time, there have been other models that have been developed that are more resistance kind of specific. Like there's one by Zhen Yan's group where they have like, there's food up above them. They have to push up
against the
cage and grab the food. And so, but food is a reward.
Yours is voluntary. I like it, but I guess I'm kind of ahead of, so I'm just thinking, if you did pure resistance training or pure weight training, would you get similar findings? But yeah, just keep going.
Sure. It's a very valid question. Mm-hmm. There is another model out there now that Troy Hornberger developed that is very much more just resistance training, but it's also very, I guess I'll say, labor intensive. Like, you have to train each mouse, like, kind of, you can train them simultaneously, but you have to like, it's like training people. You have to have somebody there to do things. Whereas this is like, they just get on the wheel, their thing.
You know? No, I think it's great. Okay.
Yeah. So that was way too much explanation for how to exercise a mouse. So anyway, we exercise the mice, right? So, and that works, and that's great. And then the next question for us was, what happens when we detrain them? You know, are they going to lose the muscle mass, lose the adaptations? That was the first question. And if they do, if we retrain them, will they gain that muscle mass back more quickly? So that was the first study we did. We introduced the model, and then we basically just stopped the mice from running after 8 weeks. We just clipped the wheels, and they just hung out in the cage. And, you know, there was a detraining response, at least in some of the muscles, which was, some didn't detrain, others did.
So how long? So 8 weeks, 8 weeks voluntary wheel running. And then how long did you detrain?
We did, oh boy, you're pushing me here. I gotta remember.
You got too many papers. You can't remember them all. Yeah.
8 weeks of training. And then I believe it was 8 weeks of detraining.
Okay.
And then in one of my, and that was the first series of studies, was just the training and then the detraining, just to look at that response. And then we followed up 8 weeks training, 8 weeks detraining, followed by 4 weeks of retraining. So like
retraining.
A shorter. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So that was the original set of studies that we did. And the first couple just focused on the training, detraining, then we added in the retraining component.
One thing I might say, because people won't necessarily know this, is, they'll be sort of thinking about, how does that relate to me, as a human? And maybe just explain a little bit about how 8 weeks for a rodent is kind of like a longer percentage of their lifespan sort of thing. So, because, I've often, we talked off before I came on that I've done some studies in rats that may have some sort of epigenetic interest. And people say, oh, yeah, but that's, that's only a six-month-old rat. And I say, yeah, but that's like a four-year-old child, for example.
Yeah. That's you do have to contextualize it within, the lifespan of that organism. And so for a mouse or a rat, for instance, you may get 24 months out of their lifespan, 2 years or so, depending. You can go more than that, but, at least in our hands, that's about getting close to the mat. And that's like 65 or 70 years in a human being, the equivalent of 24 months. So yeah, if you train a mouse for 8 weeks, that's like a significant proportion of their lifespan. that duration of training and detraining is relatively quite long, even though it's like a normal training duration for a study you might read, where they use college students or whatever. It's a semester, right? 8 weeks, or 12 weeks. So it is important to keep that in mind, where the time scales should be adjusted on how long the life of the mouse is. So, or the rat.
Good point.
Very good point.
No, it's good because people might be thinking, if I do 8 weeks, I'll get this and that. And then if I do 4 weeks, I'll get this and that. But I guess that's why eventually you need the translation, but it's very important. So I've done the same as you I literally did the same as you did my master's at Ball State. And then, starting off doing human stuff and then doing more animal work, you can look at mechanisms, but then going, can I apply this to the humans? Yeah. So why don't you tell us what you found then? So 8 weeks of training or even if it's more the follow-up one. So I saw your study here, muscle memory, and that was in mice. Why don't you tell us what you're finding generally with this training, detraining, training again to muscle fiber types and their strength and all sorts of stuff? Yeah.
Sure. So when we train the mice for 8 weeks, we see we look at the hind limbs, right? So we're looking kind of at the calf muscles, so to say. And so we find that the muscles, pretty much all of them, we have like a fiber type transition towards what would be considered a slower twitch phenotype. So theoretically more fatigue resistant. And then we see a lot of growth. We see growth of different muscle groups in the hind limb. But then we detrain the mice. Some of the muscles will atrophy and their fiber type will change back to like their untrained condition within those 8 weeks. Some muscles won't though, which was interesting to us. Like the soleus, which is a more, or at least in humans, more postural type of muscle. It's very fatigue resistant. It's a lot of slow twitch fibers. At least in the mouse, it has a similar sort of phenotype, I suppose you could say. It's smaller, it's different in a variety of ways, but fiber type wise, it has some slow twitch fibers in there. And that didn't actually detrain after like 8 weeks. And even out, and then we extended it out, I think, to 16 weeks in the follow-up study. And we saw that the soleus didn't really detrain, which we thought was interesting. Still to this day, don't have an excellent explanation for that. They did put on some weight after the training, almost as if eating more during training. And I think they continued to eat more after training. And then they put on some body weight, and that might have been loading the soleus to help kind of keep it trained, perhaps. But nevertheless, the more fast twitch type muscles, like the plantaris, they atrophy back to their kind of starting point and their fiber type switches back and things like that. And so that's what we see there. And so then that gave us impetus to go and retrain them and specifically look at the plantaris muscle, since it went kind of back down to its original size, to see if it kind of got bigger faster. So when we retrained them, it was for 4 weeks. So we originally trained them for eight, washed them out for a period of time, then just trained them for a short period of time. And the comparator there was just a naive mouse that didn't do anything except train for that 4 weeks.
Same age.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. Yep. And so when we retrained, we found that the muscles grew about 10% more with that retraining. And so that was kind of the global responses to like the muscle mass and things like that.
Okay.
I think we found some differences at the muscle fiber level as well, as far as like fibers that were growing and getting bigger, relatively more than the group that hadn't trained before. So there was some evidence for this muscle memory kind of thing going on in our mice, which has been shown before in humans too. And so so that kind of gave us some motivation to dig a little deeper and try to see if there was perhaps an explanation for that.
Okay. So yeah, if I just sort of summarize, make sure people are clear, because we sort of say fast switch, slow twitch, and you did a good job explaining it, you know, the more fatigue resistant, but yeah, just make sure people are clear. So as you said, the slow twitch fibers are more sort of fatigue resistant. So you tend to think of that more with people that are good endurance athletes. Yep. So often we biopsy the vastus lateralis, which is the quadriceps, but the one on the outside. And, you know, the average person might be 50-50, but you'll see on average an endurance trained athlete that's good. You know, you might be endurance trained, but not very good. Endurance trained person might be like 70% slow twitch. So more fatigue resistant, not so good at sprinting, that won't produce as much lactate, things like that. And then a sprinter will be sort of the other way around. They'll tend to have maybe 70% fast twitch fibers. They fatigue very quickly, but they produce a lot of force. And that's what you want, right, as a sprinter. So just to make sure people are clear on that. Now, you're saying that in your this is mice, yeah? In your mice, where they've done your resisted wheel running for 8 weeks generally, they're getting hypertrophy, so bigger muscle size, yeah? Mm-hmm. Some of their muscles are getting bigger. And you're finding when you detrain them, so when they stop training, you literally lock the wheel, that the slow fibers, so those more fatigue resistant, the ones that the endurance trained people tend to have, they actually tend to not detrain. They tend to stay about the same. And the fast fibers more tend to go back to what they were, yeah? Which is really interesting, as you say, really interesting and surprising. And I'm still like, hang on. And you said even when you wait, like 16, did you say 16?
I think it was 12 or 16 weeks, because we originally did an 8 week detrain, and then we saw the soleus didn't atrophy, and we thought that's curious. Did a whole other cohort of mice, which takes forever. Think about it. You know, you train them, you detrain them, all these things. After 12 or 16 weeks, I really should go back and look.
It's fine.
So,
and which we say, which is probably, as you said, as we talked about, it's kind of hard to compare, but if anything, it'd be longer in a human. You know, that's a long time in a mouse. So that's really interesting. But the other thing you said was that they tended to get a bit of a switching of their muscle fibers anyway. So when you train them with this resisted wheel training, they tended to get some conversion of their their faster type muscles to slow muscles. So they're getting more slow muscle fiber types, and those slow muscle fiber types don't tend to detrain. So
the soleus, that was true, but in the plantaris, we're still shifting. Like when we train them, the mice, the plantaris muscle is more, you know, type 2A, 2B, and 2X. Humans don't really have 2B, but we have the 2X in usually
fast. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, you know, but usually any type of training, whether it's resistance or endurance training, you'll move away from having those really fast sort of fibers to more homogeneous, 2A. Or either 2A in the case of the plantaris. And that's exactly what we saw when we power trained the mice. We start losing the 2Bs and Xs,
Yep.
We shifted back more towards 2B and Xs when the plantaris was trained. Yep.
Okay, that's great. So that's actually a good little segue to mention to people that they might want to listen to the excellent chat that I had with Will Durave.
Listened to that one. That was really good. I enjoyed that. Yeah.
Exactly. So if they want to understand more about this business, so basically what he's saying there is what Kevin's saying is the soleus muscle is mainly slow fibers, and then the plantaris muscle is mainly fast fibers, but you've got fast 2A, which is more sort of aerobic, but still fast. And then 2B and 2X, which as you go and have a look at Wim Durave's chat to talk about, you know, what there is in rodents versus humans. But basically, yeah, it's really interesting that whether you do endurance or strength training, you tend to lose your 2Bs or 2Xs, and they switched more to 2As. So becoming a little bit more sort of slowish sort of phenotype.
Slower, relatively, yeah.
Yeah, and more aerobic sort of thing. And anyway, so basically whether you're talking about your fast twitch muscle, which is your plantaris, which is more fast twitch, or your soleus, things are becoming more slow, more sort of aerobic, yeah. And is that even within the plantaris? Within the soleus, because I know in humans and rodents, the soleus is a little bit different. The humans tend to be like almost all slow, and I think in mice it's maybe 50-50, but you're saying you're getting more slow, yeah?
Yeah. Like with the power training, we saw a shift. Well, the soleus, as you say, in the mouse is more 2A and type 1, like 50-50-ish, we'll just say. Mm-hmm. And then you start seeing a shift more towards type 1. The thing is, like, and this is just an ongoing conversation in the muscle community, is like, you know, looking at fiber type as far as its twitch profile and fiber type, its oxidative profile, they don't always match up perfectly. Because in the mouse, the 2As tend to be very oxidative, even more so than the type 1s in many occasions.
Yeah.
So it makes it a little bit tricky.
Okay. So let's keep it simple as the way you had it, and I've now sort of complicated it. But basically you become more type 1-ish, whether it's type 1s or 2As or something, you become more sort of aerobic with the training. Now, I guess that makes me think, because I know we're going to talk about muscle memory, but just the actual training itself, it makes me think that the training, they're actually getting quite a lot of the the aerobic sort of stimulus from the running on the treadmill. It's not just the hypertrophy, which is if they were just doing the weight, do you think if they were just doing the say the squat, whether they'd get that sort of response or not?
I don't think you'd see that radical of a fiber type train. You would see, I think, see a loss of your more 2B and X. Hybrid fibers. You may not see that full transition over towards having potentially more ones or a much smaller extension of ones. But I don't think you'd see that same result. The endurance component is playing a factor here. And, you know, they're running anywhere between 8 and 12 kilometers a night when you're using younger female mice. And that's a lot.
That is really impressive, because we've done studies with mice and rats, combine them and get rice. And 8 to 10 kilometers a day is what they tend to do. And they're tiny. So it's, again, if you think about that for a human, it's like running three marathons a day, but they're actually doing that even with the resisted wheel. I mean, that's incredible.
Yeah. Well, that was the beauty of the wheel that we accidentally sort of, Corey, Dr. Dungan, my colleague, we at the time, all we had were these metal running wheels, and you know, to buy they make special running wheels that are weighted running wheels, where it's like a brake that you put on the wheel and you gradually increase the friction with the brake on the wheel, but then they get to a point where they can't even move the wheel. Stop running. Whereas we put the weights just on one side of the wheel, and it made it kind of like lopsided, and so it facilitated them running very high volumes, still with a lot of weight on the wheel, up to like 20% of their body mass on the wheel. They would still run this amount, and so that was sort of the secret sauce with the model to get it to work. Right. Yeah, it was accidental. Not like it was something we had necessarily planned. It's just that was what was available. That's what we did.
Great. Right. So the muscle memory part, which is I keep getting caught up on these details because I love all this stuff.
That's fun.
All right. So the muscle memory bit, right? So you're saying about 10, so you're saying when they did the same, here's a question. Okay. Hang on. So they got about 10% greater hypertrophy when you did it the second time than the first time. So you're saying that's the muscle memory bit because they've responded quicker, but were they doing the same amount of, the great thing about voluntary wheel running is it's voluntary and you're not having to stimulate them, and they're choosing it off their own accord. So they're not getting the stress. You know, they get a lot of stress. If you put a mouse or a rat on a treadmill, you're making it run. If you, plus or minus electrical stimulation, we don't do that here. We just blow air on them. But anyway, it's stressful. They hate it. Okay. So then you get the cortisol and adrenaline and all that stuff, which is not real life. And then you wonder how much of your findings are the stress response and how much of the training and all this crap. So when voluntary wheel running, you haven't got that. So it's fantastic. And I'm a huge fan of it. But I'm just wondering, it's also a bit difficult to match the training though. So did they do the same training the second time?
Fortunately, yes. In that particular group, they did, which was great. And I mean, if you do a big enough group of my, I mean, these, again, these are hard studies to do and they take a lot of time and resources and money and all these things. But if you had a large enough cohort, you could also kind of like match them one for one as far as their volume goes. You're going to have a range of volumes and the, they're not all just going to run exactly 10, right? Like you're going to get a range.
It's variable.
And so on average, the ones that had trained previously that trained again, they ran just about the exact same amount as the ones that were naive, which worked out great. Very concerned about this too. And I think it was like ends of six per group at that point. And so I was very concerned that like, oh, they're all gonna run way more because they had already been exposed to the wheel. They remember it. They're going to hop on, just get right to it. But fortunately the mice typically take pretty quickly to the running wheel. In my experience, usually after a couple of days, they kind of figure it out. Within a week, they almost always do. And so, and we give them a week of acclimation too, just to like, for them to get back in their back in the groove, so to say. So they did run the same amount.
That's fantastic.
A very great question. It's an important question. If they ran different volumes, what do you attribute hypertrophy to, right?
Exactly. So, yeah. And you got about 10% more hypertrophy on average, which is not massive, but it's obviously came up significant with you
in. Yeah. And it's not massive, but it's also not, I mean, when humans resistance train, like you're not going to see a doubling of muscle size in a matter of weeks, like you sometimes do with like surgical models of hypertrophy for mice. So it was more akin to like maybe what you'd start to see if somebody was resistance training.
Sorry. I thought you meant 10% different.
No, they gain 10%. Yeah, they gain 10% more than the naive groups.
Yeah. Okay. So what, just out of interest, how much of a hypertrophy are we getting? So when you do the first time, do they get a, I don't know, what percent? And then, you know, how much are we comparing?
We're talking about like, I guess we'll just talk about in terms of mass. Like the soleus, I think 20 to 25% and the plantaris is like 15 to 20, I think. The soleus gets a little more activated with the running, which I think makes sense because it's, you know, going to be a muscle that's responsible for plantar flexion. The plantaris does that too, but the soleus definitely gets a pretty good amount of stimulation from this type of running. So yeah, about, I would say 25% on the soleus and maybe like 15 to 20 on the plantaris.
So just to make sure we're clear, because I'm slightly confused. So soleus got a 25% increase in muscle size, the first time. And then when you said it got 10% more, are you saying it got 27.5%?
Oh, okay. So let's talk about the plantaris for this because the soleus retrained. So the retraining data was.
You're right.
Plantaris, it's a good question. I'd have to see exact. I'd have to go back to because they didn't. It was only a 4-week training. So typically, when we power train the mice, we're just barely starting to see significance with hypertrophy.
Yeah, exactly.
4 weeks in the naive state, right? So they're just starting to grow by 4 weeks. So it's a very. So I would say that, if memory is serving, they were probably like, they probably grew like 13 or 14% or something in that 4 week. And maybe the naive only grew a couple percentage, right? Because relatively short term. So maybe that, hopefully that clears it up.
So it's quite substantial.
If the naive mice didn't really grow all that much in the first 4 weeks. Hypertrophy.
Oh, that's substantial then. Okay.
Starting to get it. And then,
thinking you were saying 10%. So if you went from up, if you increased by 40%, then the second time you'd increase by 44%. You know, 10% more.
I probably misspoke. So
No, that's good. No, that's a lot then. That's a lot. So you're saying it's actually substantially more the second time with the muscle memory side of things.
I think the remaining question is like, you know, is it that they just hypertrophy more quickly, or they'll ultimately hypertrophy more? That they would just hypertrophy, they would just get to their plateau faster, right? So maybe by 8 weeks, the muscle mass would be the same between the naive and the previous group. It's just they had a steeper curve or steeper.
That was what I was going to ask you, but I guess you haven't had a chance to look at that yet. You haven't looked at the time course?
We didn't retrain them out to 8 weeks because for our initial question, we really just wanted to see, do they grow back faster? And that was what we were scared of. If we went out to 8 weeks, we might have missed our time.
Might have plateaued already.
Yeah, exactly. And so we're like, okay, we'll do half the time.
It's nice stuff. All right. So I can't let you go without this. Why do the slow twitch not, the soleus, why do they not? Okay. So I'm sure you've looked at a lot of things in here, in the muscles. So is it that they didn't hypertrophy? So I'm just trying to get my head around how it is 12, 16 weeks that this that you stop, that you do the detraining and they don't detrain the soleus, yeah. So the one that's more slow fiber, slow phenotype, even though it's a bit of both. Hang on. So what didn't they do? Sorry. So did they not hypertrophy? Did they not change their fiber type back again? Did they not do anything? I know you measured microRNA and all sorts of things. Did nothing really change?
So when we train them for the 8 weeks, the soleus again will grow pretty substantially. Let's just say 25%. I don't know. It's in that range from baseline. And so, but yeah, when we looked eight, and I believe it was 12 or 16 weeks, 12, we'll just say, after we stopped them from running, everything we looked at least histologically, everything was just the same. Like the fiber type, you know, they picked up more type 1 fibers during the training, and they retained those for the detrain. Their fibers got bigger and they just didn't go back to being smaller. And gained more myonuclei, so muscle fiber nuclei from the satellite cells, which we can talk about. They picked those up during the training too, and then they didn't lose them
during the detraining.
So it was like just a universal, like, just whatever they got during the training, they just kept. And they also again put on body mass during the detraining.
They said that. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and I think it has something to do with, I don't know, I call it like the college athlete effect, right? Like you're super fit in college, you're eating all this food to support your mass and to support your athleticism. And then you get out of college and you stop performing at the super high level and you continue.
All right. But I think we have to say in humans, you don't get this. So if we forget about the muscle memory, if we just look at humans that have done weight training or endurance training, and then they detrain, I think it's fair to say you don't get this, or
generally,
you wouldn't keep the muscle mass, you wouldn't keep the fiber type changes and things. Do you think is that a species? What do we make of that? I guess.
Yeah, I've thought about it, of course, and you know, it's hard for me to make heads or tails of it. But I guess one thing I could say is that, like, it probably depends very much on the muscle and the fiber type percentage, and probably just the function of the muscle that you're looking at. When you think about the soleus, for instance, like if people put on fat mass, they get larger, they eat a lot, and they become, obese or whatever. A lot of times their leg muscles, their calves specifically, will get bigger. And so it could be, and that's probably mostly soleus because it's a postural muscle and it's just being loaded heavier and heavier every single step for their whole lives. And so, yeah, I guess it would make sense.
That's a fair point. Because when I talk about humans, so if you did go back and look at every human study that sort of looked at training and fiber type changes and whatever, almost all the training stuff that's been done in humans has been the vastus lateralis, which is, you know, again, the quads, which is not really strictly a postural muscle. And then if you do look at runners, you often biopsy the calf, but it's the gastroc. It's not the soleus. Yeah. More and more people do look at the soleus now. So I think that's a good, fair point. I guess I'm willing to pay that, because soleus is, like, as you say, a postural muscle. So these muscles that are closer to the bone, that sort of deep muscles, not the superficial ones, tend to be postural. So, you know, we're talking about walking around and things like that. So, yeah, it's possible that there may be changes that, you know, I guess it hasn't really been looked at that much in humans, I guess. Yeah. Like training and then detraining and looking at the soleus.
Yeah, I don't think so. If it's out there, then it's probably more in the context of endurance training. We're talking about resistance here. And the soleus is, at least for the human beings, for their low, it takes up a good, I think it's the bigger muscle of the calf, if I'm not, than the gastroc. I think it's bigger. But it lays underneath, you know, the gastroc. And so it's a little harder to access. And when you biopsy it, as you probably know, you go in from the side. You know, you have people laying on their stomach going from the side. I think I had one of those when I was at Ball State, even a soleus. I'm pretty sure I did. I don't remember. I had a lot.
You know, it's a classic. I can't say this without. So we're talking about Ball State, right? So I was at Ball State and it's fantastic. So people, if they haven't had a look, they need to have a look at David Kostel's chat with me. It's the longest one so far. And I just love that guy. Anyway, so he was, you know, he is Ball State basically until he left, he finished. And then Scott Trapper, your supervisor, took over. But anyway, I have to say, you might not like me saying this, but he told me how he biopsied himself one day. He stood there, put his leg up against the chair and biopsied his calf. He didn't do a soleus, as far as I know. But anyway, yeah, that's fun.
But yeah, that's sounds like something Doc would do.
Yeah, it's great stuff. All right, so if we start thinking about mechanisms then, yes? So maybe if we can talk about, you've touched on satellite cells and things like that. Maybe if we just talk about, because seeing as the title of this one is epigenetics and muscle memory, if we just talk about, genetics versus epigenetics. What is epigenetics? Just a bit of a background. We've talked about it before on the podcast, but people may not have seen it. And what we're getting at here, because it used to just be everything was genetics, right? Charles Darwin, genetics. There's nothing else. And now we're thinking more about epigenetics as well. Epigenetics and genetics. So do you want to just explain that a little bit?
Yeah, I think like in layman's terms, I guess the way I would think about epigenetics versus genetics is like genetics is like, can you express the gene? And epigenetics is like, will you express the gene? So it's changing gene expression without an alteration to the genetic code. So it's like, yeah, we have all these genes, like all of us have these genes, and they get turned on and turned off in response to various things. But what controls largely that turning off and turning on of genes is the epigenetic layer, which is the things that are kind of either impeding or making the genes available to be expressed. And so that's really kind of what we're talking more about, kind of a regulatory layer on top of genetics. That when we're thinking about genetics versus epigenetics, we're, just a lot of times thinking about epigenetics being the intent. So like, is the gene going to be expressed? So turning it off and turning it on, we have it, but it needs to be turned off or turned on. The epigenetic layer kind of controls that. And it comes in a lot of different flavors, like talking about histone modifications and DNA methylation. And some might even qualify microRNAs as part of that conversation. Uh-huh. And so yeah, it's that's the way I'm thinking about epigenetics, is what's controlling whether a gene gets expressed.
Exactly. But can I also add another layer? So the Charles Darwin type thing is the classic thing, which is, if a giraffe has a long neck, is it because it's been reaching up its whole life, or is it because, the father and the mother had long necks and then it got passed on? And the other thing about epigenetics is you can actually pass it on. So it's the controlling during a lifetime, but also, things that you do during a lifetime can be passed on, even though the genes themselves aren't changed, the likelihood of them being expressed in the next generation is passed on. So I just wanted to bring out that distinction. So people might want to see Laurie Goodyear's chat on here. And I've done some work on that as well, where you can, for example, we did like a high fat fed father. And then, the offspring is more likely to get diabetes. And then she's even looked at the next generation now. Yeah. So that has to be epigenetics. Exactly. It has to be epigenetics because you haven't changed the genes. So, but as you say, though, also during your lifetime. So an example that sometimes you think about is people that have uncontrolled diabetes. So they've got elevated glucose for 20 years or something. And then they control it really perfectly for the next 20 years. They still have worse outcomes than people that have had good control the whole way. So it's like, okay, something happened earlier in their life, which is still having an effect later. Yeah, is that fair to say, those sort of distinctions? Yeah.
I think so. And I mean, I think about it in that context, mostly with exercise. Like I'm talking about what's happening within your lifespan, what's happening in your somatic cells within your muscle cells, so not like your germ cells. So yeah, that's definitely how I'm thinking of things. But it's the opposite. Like you're thinking about diabetes and perhaps bad outcomes, and I'm trying to think about more about good outcomes, like
good
exercise.
Outcomes.
What are the good things that it's imprinting or something into your epigenetic code to make it beneficial throughout your whole life, even if you stop doing it,
Exactly. Well, we actually it's not about my stuff, but we actually did a thing of if a rat was born small, or if the father had high fat diet, you exercise the offspring from just 5 weeks to 9 weeks of age, and you fixed a lot of their problems. So that was really cool. Yeah, so it's
Love
really
that.
Cool. But exercise is great. Couldn't let that one go. So you're talking about here a situation where they do the exercise, they get an adaptation, they detrain, and then they train again and they get a quicker, or we don't know if it's quicker, I guess, but a greater response. And how do you tie that in maybe with epigenetics? Yeah.
Well, I mean, I think I would be remiss if I didn't talk about like the cellular foundations of what muscle memory is thought to be, which, there was a lot of work done in 2010-ish, in that time frame, early before and after that, a couple of years, but a guy named Christian Gunderson, who kind of laid the foundation for our knowledge in this, and for like kind of, well, what causes muscle memory. And he did a whole series of different studies using mice and rats, looking at the number of nuclei in the muscle fiber, right? Because muscle fibers are multinuclear. They're not mononuclear cells like most of the cells in our body. They're these long cylinders, and they have hundreds to thousands of nuclei in them. And those nuclei are thought to not divide, whether post-mitotic or, you know, whether they can synthesize DNA. You had Benjamin Miller on here, so he talked about that, I'm sure. But yeah, whether or not they can divide and replenish themselves, I think is pretty established that they can't do that. And so, but you can pick up, you can gain more nuclei within a given muscle fiber from your stem cells. And usually when the muscle fiber grows, a stem cell will become activated and it'll fuse into the muscle fiber and add a new
nuclei. Just go a little bit slower. So this is, it's kind of hard stuff. So yeah, just, you're saying that most cells, so if you look at your cells in your gut or whatever, they'll have one nucleus, yeah, that contains the DNA. And you're saying like our muscle, skin cells, and our muscle cells, you say, have hundreds of thousands?
Hundreds to thousands, yeah.
I thought that made more sense. I thought you said hundreds of thousands.
Hundreds of thousands.
Yeah, hundreds to thousands of nuclei. So it's really interesting. So each cell that contains all your DNA, so each nucleus that contains all the DNA for your body is replicated many times within the one muscle cell, yes? And then you're saying this replenishing them and things like that. So maybe just go there, but just go a bit slower and
and then
what happens with resistance training and things like that. Yep.
Sure. Okay. So within the muscle fiber is going to be many nuclei. So all of the copies of the DNA, there's numerous nuclei that have an individual copy of, you know, all your DNA in each one of those. Whereas a normal cell, a skin cell, an eye cell, whatever, is just one small cell that has one nucleus in it. So it just has like one complete copy of your DNA. Yep. The muscle fiber, on the other hand, might have hundreds or thousands of nuclei, which means it has hundreds or thousands of copies of your DNA, which is crazy. It's called a syncytium. And so it's, you know, just it's multinuclear. And so all these nuclei are having to work in concert to regulate this.
This is amazing to think about. Yeah.
And usually voluminous, I guess, the big volume. The cells have big volume. They're very, very large cells. I mean, a muscle fiber, if you pull out an individual muscle fiber, you can like see it with your eye. Whereas like an individual skin cell, you can't do that. Like these muscle fibers are massive and they have lots of nuclei. And it's thought that these nuclei are what help support their size. Because if you only have one nucleus for a, what I'll call a super massive cell, it probably wouldn't be able to control the entire cell. It would, the cell would die or it'd be very inefficient. It's a really unique, one of the very many cool things about muscle is the fact that it's this big, each cell is a big multinuclear syncytium.
It's funny though, because when we're talking about these big cells, I still want people to understand how small these things are. So for example, when you have a muscle biopsy, which we talked about, and I've had 33 of them, you're taking out, we often say like two or three rice grains size, which is actually quite a big sample. But I remember when I've done fiber typing on my muscle, so one biopsy, I remember one was 572 muscle fibers, because you have it on cross section and you cut 572 muscle fibers. So I want people to realize that even when you have a couple of rice grain size, there's 570 fibers in there. So when we're saying these are big, they're big compared to other cells, but everything's like tiny, so when you think about these tiny, you got 570 fibers in this one biopsy, and then each fiber has hundreds to thousands of nuclei. It's just like, hang on a minute. So anyway, it is mind-boggling.
Mind-boggling.
Yeah, I remember my mum at one stage, I said to her how red blood cells, I said there was 6 million red blood cells per cubic millimeter. Uh-huh. And she's like, hang on, what? And I'm like, explaining. She's like, no, I don't want to hear it. It blew away. because then I said each red blood cell has, all these millions of hemoglobin. It's like, oh, go away. So yeah, it's kind of fun to think about. Okay, so these muscle fibers are big in compared to other fibers, compared to other cells.
Big in the scale of biological things, I guess.
Yes, and they have all these nuclei. Now, why is that important, and how are we going to fit that back to muscle memory and things?
Sure. Yeah. So, I mean, it's important, I think, that these muscle fibers have all these nuclei, because these nuclei are like, they're the control centers of the cell, right? They're all the, of every cell, they're the control center of the cell. So they have all the DNA, which means they express the genes, which become the proteins that then become the structure of that cell and function of that cell as well. And so, yeah, having hundreds to thousands of these nuclei mean that like each nucleus has to kind of like govern its own little area, so to say. The myonuclear domain, right? And so like maybe there's 100 nuclei in a given muscle cell, and each one controls the area like immediately around it. And then the one next to it picks up and controls the area that's adjacent to that one.
Perfect.
And so it's just so that you can have like an even distribution of gene products, proteins, mRNAs, all these things. And so, and it's thought that when the muscle grows, that you have to add in these new nuclei, because the nuclei can't replenish them. So they can't divide. They're what we call postmitotic. And so they, you know, you can go listen to Benjamin Miller's talk and he'll say some things, but for the most part, they won't divide. Like, we don't think they're going to divide. They can maybe synthesize DNA, but they can't divide themselves. And so if the muscle were to grow and you needed a new nucleus because the muscle got bigger, you'd have to fuse that in from a stem cell or a satellite cell. And so, and they're these cells that all of us have them, and they're responsible for injury repair. If you like really severely injured your muscle, the stem cells would activate and would rebuild the muscle. But if with exercise, for instance, if you're growing the muscle, like with hypertrophy, those stem cells would activate and they would donate their nucleus to the muscle fiber so that the muscle fiber can continue to grow. And so that's sort of the thinking. And whether or not that process is necessary for hypertrophy is a long conversation. And so I spent a long time studying that, you know, during my postdoc. And so, and there's a lot of different opinions. So we can go there later if you want. But for the purposes of muscle memory, though.
And as you said, Benjamin Miller talked about that stuff as well. He said if he inhibited satellite cells, you know, he got this and that. So people can go and look at that. But yeah, for the purposes of...
And we can do that. We can delete the stem cells from the muscle altogether and do all types of things. It's very, very cool. So, but yeah, we can definitely talk about that if you want. But so for the sake of muscle memory, though, you go to the gym, you lift a weight, your muscle gets bigger. Eventually, those stem cells fuse in, and then you end up with a bigger muscle fiber that has more nuclei in it. And that's supposed to be to help your muscle to continue to grow and adapt. And so back to Christian Gunderson, he did a lot of work in 2010 around that time frame, using mouse models, rat models, using anabolic steroids, using different sorts of resistance training analogs and rodents. And he came up to the conclusion that when you gain a nucleus during hypertrophy, if you were to stop training and that same muscle fiber were to atrophy, that nucleus you gained, he said, wouldn't go away. So it's a permanent addition to the muscle fiber. And because when you start training again, you start with a higher baseline of nuclei fibers, that then you'd be able to grow back more quickly. And I think, you know, that's makes clever sense. And that's, it does make sense. I think that's a very intuitive sort of thing that he was able to experimentally in his hand show that that's how that worked. And that was interesting. And so but a lot of the experiments that that looked at that specific sort of mechanism, they used surgical models of overload, or used again anabolic steroids and different things like that. So we wanted to approach it from a more translatable perspective with our power model, right? So you train the mice and we can detrain them, and there's no surgeries or drugs or any of these things. And so when we did repeated the study doing training detraining with what would be a more translatable model, we didn't find that to be the case. We actually found that the nuclei, we don't know how, but the nuclei that you gain during hypertrophy seemed to go away during the detraining. So that we found that like it went back down to baseline levels.
Which is more pleasing to me anyway, because your whole thing about, I was thinking about, we have a thing around here called neighborhood watch, you know, where the people, you know, keep a watch on their neighborhood. And it was making me think somehow that each, you know, each myonuclei, so each muscle nucleus is watching its own neighborhood, right? It's looking after its own turf, right? Sure. But then if you expand the neighborhood, then you need more neighborhood watch. But if you shrink it down, you don't need it again. You know, sorry, we don't need you guys. And it makes more sense that you get rid of the extra nuclei than you keep them, because it doesn't fit with the whole point that you need X amount of nuclei to look after their own area.
Right. And I mean, the myonuclear domain, as you are sort of expressing right now, you know, it works both ways. You know, it probably works with hypertrophy when the muscle gets bigger, but also with atrophy too, you would think. And I don't know if the time scale always matches up, you know, like I think probably the muscle fiber would atrophy quicker than you would lose a nucleus. And we don't know how you lose
chicken and the egg.
Yeah, we're still trying to kind of unravel that. And there's people that are going after that question. I think it's fascinating if that process is happening, how that occurs. Is it like, is it apoptosis of individual nuclei and nuclear autophagy?
Cell death.
Like there's a lot of, like with apoptosis.
So when you say terms like apoptosis, just say what that is.
Sure, yeah, like apoptosis would be cell death, but in a syncytium, so when you have a muscle fiber that has hundreds of nuclei, if you just lose one nucleus, well, the cell's probably not going to die. So it's like, it's nuclear apoptosis, I guess. And so, but how that process might occur is very much a mystery, I think, still at this point.
All right. So you're saying when you do the strength, well, the running wheel, which is overload, so kind of strength training, they get hypertrophy and they get more myonuclei, so more muscle nucleus, which makes sense. But then when you detrain them, you said, unlike Gunderson, he kept their myonuclei even with the detraining. So when they lost their hypertrophy, but you didn't lose yours. Is that right? And that's that slow and fast fibers.
In the plantaris muscle, we did not see. In the soleus, again, the muscle didn't detrain. So in that instance, they stayed. Okay. And so
That's a nice control for your model.
It was, because in that sense, yeah.
Yeah, because you might say, oh, there's just technical differences or something. But the fact that you had the soleus that didn't detrain and they kept their myonuclei, and the plantaris that did detrain and they lost their myonuclei, that's a nice control.
And we did that several different ways, too. We isolated out individual fibers and counted nuclei, like, longitudinally on the whole muscle fiber, or portion of the muscle fiber. And we did it with histology as well, which is another popular way to, like, measure these things. And so we did it a couple different ways. We got the same result. So our conclusion from at least these mouse studies was that this hypothesis may be a little more nuanced, and maybe there's more conversation to be had about what a potential muscle memory mechanism could be. Because if it's not a maintenance of the myonuclei that you gained from hypertrophy, perhaps it's a difference within the myonuclei that are there. That was kind of our thought process. Maybe that's could be related.
Okay. All right. So I managed to sort of confuse things slightly there. So I think it's nice. You're finding that you have hypertrophy, you get more myonuclei, and then if you detrain, you lose it. Makes sense in terms of the myonuclear domain and looking after the neighborhood and all that. But it doesn't help explain your muscle memory thing. So you're saying, you were thinking, as Gunderson showed, I guess, that if you train, you get more myonuclei, you detrain, you lose, you keep them, and then you train again. So maybe that's why you do better. So you're saying, because you didn't see that, it seems like maybe that is not the reason in terms of the number of myonuclei, but maybe the myonuclei that are already there are more sort of ready to go.
Sure, yeah.
More ready to express genes. Yeah.
Yeah, that was our hypothesis. And that was, you know, kind of the hypothesis that I mentioned Adam Sharples when he did, like, that's what they were looking at. They weren't looking at nuclear numbers. They were looking at epigenetic changes.
Epigenetic, perfect. So that brings us to epigenetics. So then you're saying, okay, so maybe there's epigenetic changes so that the genes that are there, you don't have more total genetic material because you don't have more myonuclei, but the myonuclei that are there, so the genetic material that's there already is more likely to turn on. Turns on quicker or to a greater extent in response to the second lot of training, yeah? So the muscle memory.
That was sort of our thinking, yeah. That's what we wanted to kind of try.
Now, do you have any evidence for that?
Yeah, so we did a study to kind of try and suss this out a little bit where we were interested in looking at the myonuclei now, but we're interested in doing some molecular measures of them, you know, so not necessarily counting their numbers, but isolating the nuclei out and then doing some different sort of assays to say, okay, maybe there is like an epigenetic and epi memory of the previously trained state that remains when you are retraining. And so we had a mouse model where we could genetically label the muscle fiber nuclei, the myonuclei, with a green fluorescent protein. So just to make them turn green so that we could identify them. Then we just do some different biochemical sort of assays to isolate out these fluorescent nuclei. And then we looked at the epigenetic profile of the myonuclei after the detraining period to see if there was like a memory of what the training state looked like at the epigenetic level. So looking at like essentially gene accessibility, we'll say, for in layman's terms, and found that, yeah, there were some genes that kind of had a profile that would be suggestive of they still kind of had their trained phenotype, so to say. So they had epigenetic marks around them that would suggest that perhaps they could be activated more quickly or more readily to help facilitate a retraining response that would maybe drive greater hypertrophy with retraining. And this dovetailed with other work done by Adam Sharples and some other folks that found a very similar thing, that there may be this memory of the trained state in the myonuclei, presumably, but also that, you know, there could be even be like a more dramatic gene expression, like response with the retraining that would help facilitate the muscle growing back more quickly. And so that was kind of in broad strokes what we sort of found with these studies that we're doing. And we're still kind of going after this and trying to understand on a deeper level, like which epigenetic layers potentially could be important for, you know, driving regrowth. And we did all these studies with looking specifically at the myonuclei, but we did some other things too, where we were looking at like different types of transcripts or messages that are produced by the nuclei. And we found that there's a specific microRNA that also stays repressed during the detraining period. So when you train, this microRNA goes down. I can tell you what a microRNA is, but it's basically a small RNA that binds to other larger RNAs and either causes them to not get turned into protein or to degrade. So basically as a way of fine tuning what genes get made into proteins. We found that there is a change in this microRNA profile that was persistent throughout the entire detraining period. So out to like 12 weeks. And we thought that was interesting in that it may be related to how the muscle is more responsive to the retraining. And so we did a couple different things and we're still not 100% sure. It's hard to link these things mechanistically, right? These are associations still, even though we're doing kind of some sophisticated molecular work.
I do a summary thing just before you go to that next step. Absolutely. I just want to make sure people are okay. So just want to make sure tie in again, because the epigenetics thing is still a bit new to people. So, you know how we talked earlier about how, you know, your genes don't really change during your lifetime when they don't get changed, passing on, you know, to generations, but the likelihood of these genes turning on. So there's these epigenetic markers. Yeah. So, you know, you touched on a few things earlier, but we won't get into that too much, you know, methylation and all that. So these epigenetic markers may still, which affect the likelihood to turn on or turn off. It sounds like some of those, and ones that you think are important for hypertrophy, that the genes that are important for hypertrophy, some of them have these epigenetic markers on them still after the detraining, yeah? And they didn't change. So then it's more likely they're going to turn on again. Is that what you're saying?
Sure. I think that's a fair assessment. Yeah, I think that's pretty sums up pretty well. Yep.
All right, perfect. And sorry, can I say, do they turn on more? So when you have these, you got, okay, this gene has a marker on it that makes it, that we think is going to make it more likely to turn on again. But then when you do the detraining, the retraining, so when you go and train them again, do those genes turn on again?
And in our study, ours wasn't, for the mouse studies, we didn't set it up to answer that question because we didn't have like an acute exercise bout in each state. So we didn't have them like do a bout of exercise and look at their gene expression response. It would have just been, we would have had to kill too many mice to pull that off. And so we just looked at the ultimate outcome. But other studies like Adam's study did, not mistaken, show that some of those genes that have those that memory are more responsive in the trained state to like a bout of exercise. And that's probably really where it's coming in, is like each bout of exercise, you're getting that like little extra something from having that, you know, epigenetic memory that's ultimately contributing additively to the bigger response.
And this actually reminds me, because, you know, my main background's been glucose metabolism, and it maybe explains the thing. So there's a glucose transporter, which I know you're aware of, I'm just telling the audience, called GLUT4. So, you know, it moves to the membrane and brings in glucose. Yeah. So when you contract, the transporter moves to the membrane, brings in the glucose. It can also do it in response to insulin. Insulin, GLUT4 moves the membrane, brings in the glucose, right?
Yeah.
Now, the interesting thing is that each bout of exercise, your GLUT4 expression goes up and then comes down again. but it tends to be kind of additive. So you know, it's going up. So if people aren't watching YouTube, they won't see the because a lot of people do Spotify. But you know, it's going up, it's coming down, but not all the way down again. And then you do your next bout, it comes up and it goes down, but not quite down again. And this is the messenger RNA, which we sort of started talking about. So the gene, the DNA gets converted to messenger RNA. Well, it turns on messenger RNA, which then causes a protein. Okay, transfer RNA, and then you end up with a protein, which is GLUT4. Yep. And this message from each bout, the messenger RNA, is going up and then coming down. So anyway, it's not going down. So I'm wondering, you know, maybe that's an example of epigenetics. So the fact that training is, you know, sometimes we say that training is a series of single exercise bouts, right? And it's always, I've always thought about this, and I thought, hang on a minute, but it's additive. So maybe this epigenetics going on there. So I don't know if you want to say in your own words what you were starting to say as well, to fill in the gaps for people. Just like I tried to fill in the gaps, maybe you fill in some more gaps.
Yeah, I think it's probably, like as you say, related to that, like every exercise bout is contributing to the ultimate outcome. And like, yeah, with each exercise bout, if you had, if you started in a slightly different, let's just say more favorable place epigenetically, you're able to access those genes more quickly.
That's really cool.
A messenger RNA that then becomes a protein. So you ultimately end up with more of the protein after each repeated bout, and then you get a greater adaptive response after a period of time. So 8 weeks, 12 weeks, what have you. And so, yeah, I mean, that's, I guess, intuitively what I would think is happening, but I haven't tested that specific hypothesis, but I can kind of draw from other areas of literature, other studies to point that that could be problem, a potential explanation. And it could be related to epigenetics. It could be related to these changes in microRNAs that are maybe long lasting. It could probably, if I had to guess, some memory is probably happening at a variety of different levels. And how long that memory lasts is a other can of worms. I don't know. Right.
And that's partly why I've kind of pulled you back a little bit, because I just felt like we might have been getting away. So I don't want to cut off the microRNA bit, but I just want to make sure people were aware. You've got the DNA, the messenger RNA, the transfer RNA, and then you end up with the protein. Why don't you tell us now, just and again, kind of basically, but what the microRNA business is and what you found?
Sure. So within the framework of the study design with the mice I've been talking about. So we train the mice and then we detrain the mice. And then we look to see what things are potentially long lasting after the training has ceased. And we measured a variety of things, as you say, mRNAs. But another thing we looked at was microRNAs, which are basically these really kind of short RNAs that get generated, you know, from the same genetic code from our DNA. They come from there. And sometimes they even embedded in other genes and they get processed and become these little kind of like free floating little RNAs that can then go interact with the messenger RNAs. So they basically kind of have a mate, or maybe a lot of mates, because it's a little sequence that it is comprised of, and it'll go and interact with a messenger RNA or maybe a lot of different messenger RNAs and either stop them from becoming proteins by preventing them from being translated or degrading them so they don't have a chance to get translated. And so it's sort of a way to fine tune. So you may express a gene and that would be signal intent for it to become a protein. It doesn't always, right? It's not a one-to-one, like a gene get expressed becomes a protein. It's not like always that linear. There's some nuance there. But it's another way in which, like, okay, let's say a gene got expressed, but then the cell didn't need it. The microRNA could come in, bind to it, signal for it to get degraded, and it doesn't become protein. That's that.
Nice.
And so, we consider microRNAs generally to be repressors, you know, because they're going to shut down the translation of a specific mRNA. It can have a variety of different biological effects, of course, but we found that there was a specific microRNA which is enriched in muscle specifically. It's called a myomer. So myo, the prefix being microRNA, mer. We found one of these myomers. It went down with exercise training, and then it stayed down for like a very long period of time after training. And we think that microRNA could have been like serving as a break on certain transcripts that were related to growth. And then if that break is already off when you start training again, it could be easier for you to get a response. So another kind of molecular layer at which this retraining response, muscle memory response, could be working. And like I said, I think it's probably working on several different layers.
Okay. And as you said, microRNAs have lots of mates. So they tend to affect more than one gene or protein. Yeah. Again, did it make sense, you know, like when you actually look at the proteins? Because, I mean, in some ways it's easy to say, oh, this was down, therefore whatever. But did the proteins that it interacts with, did that fit with your hypothesis as well?
Well, because it's MIR1 and it seems to target things that are specifically related to growth, like IGF-1 and different growth oriented sort of proteins. Yeah, the fact that MIR1 was down could have been indicative of that. It was serving as a break for some of these growth oriented processes. But then you just remove that break, and then when you introduce the stimulus, exercise, retraining, then the muscle can sort of take off again. So we did hypothesize that. We did present that as our explanation, yeah. But we did some computational analysis, but we didn't go in. And actually, now we have a way of testing this. So this is something I'm actively working on. But at that time, it was just a hypothesis. And it still is to an extent, but we are working
on it. No, I think it's really cool stuff. Really cool stuff. Now, you emailed me at one stage saying you're introducing a new mouse model, which we've discussed, and challenges some widely held beliefs on muscle memory. So maybe just circle around again. So you're saying it looks like it's more maybe epigenetic and not so much the myo. But as you say, there's probably layers of what are we challenging here? That the highly, take us back to the widely held beliefs.
Sure.
Well, what they were again.
With muscle memory, the widely held belief, I think, was that if you gained a nucleus from a satellite cell, that was permanent. Like, so if the muscle atrophied, you would have like a hypernucleated muscle fiber. Okay, so if the muscle fiber had 100 nuclei, maybe now it has 125, but it's still back to the size that it was, but it just has more nuclei. So it can take off faster when you retrain. And I don't want to discount that hypothesis. I think in some instances that could, maybe it's muscle type dependent. Maybe it depends on the age at which you started exercising. So if it was like a younger animal that you exercise, maybe that's when that mechanism becomes really operational. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of considerations here, and I'm not trying to discard hypothesis.
Now, another thing I realized was, I guess we're doing a very DNA centric, although you did touch on breakdown as well. I wonder if there's other epigenetic things that are going on. So, you know, we tend to talk, you know, same when you talk about protein synthesis, you tend to think about, when you think about protein levels, you tend to think about the synthesis, and it's like, it's a bit harder to measure the breakdown, you know? So I'm wondering if it's the same thing. I'm wondering if it's the same thing here, where it's maybe a bit easier to think about the synthesis of the protein and not the breakdown. So wonder if there's an epigenetic thing going on as well with the muscle memory, where your lysosome or even breaking down. We haven't talked about the mitochondria, but just the breaking down side, there might be a memory. So it's like, okay, we've made these proteins, let's not break them down as quickly the second time.
Right. It very well could be. I mean, I would be inclined to think that if you did lose a nucleus, you would maybe lose some of the other, like, because you can lose mitochondria, as you kind of pointed to. Like, I mean, if you stop training, you lose mitochondria. I think it stands to reason that if you stopped resistance training, you could lose a nucleus too. I mean, mitochondria have their own DNA as well.
That's true.
And so I think DNA or nuclei could be the same. I mean, it could very well be related to some breakdown process that I haven't thought about, but I'd be inclined to think that the muscle would probably be maintaining something in the DNA because there's so many nuclei.
I guess it goes back to DNA. But I guess what I'm getting at is the muscle memory part. That maybe the lysosomes or whatever it is that's breaking down proteins, maybe they have a memory. You know what I mean?
Oh, yeah. So like maybe so
they're less likely to break it down.
Hmm. Yeah, potentially. I guess what I can say with muscle memory from what I've read, I don't think people have really done much. Well, I guess in the sense that like fiber type changes back, at least in the plantaris, changes back to, its's baseline phenotype. And that's a protein measure when we measure fiber type. I don't know. I just don't know enough about that, nor have I seen any evidence to suggest
that. No, just something I threw out there.
I don't want to go out on a crazy limb because I really don't know.
No, I'm not suggesting you know that, but I guess Well, you know, like I said, with protein levels for years and years, it was just protein synthesis, protein synthesis, protein synthesis. But then it's been like, well, hang on, what about the breakdown? You know, so just to make sure people are clear what I'm talking about. So just say you do weight training, you get an increase in your muscle mass, your hypertrophy, and you say, oh, there's been an increase in your muscle protein synthesis. But in theory, you could get an increase in your muscle mass by just not changing your protein synthesis, but reducing the protein breakdown. So I just have to make sure people are clear on that.
I think in that instance, though, like at least with that example, though, like you do want, of course you want protein turnover, right? Like I think it just from, you know, global perspective, like, you know, keeping bad stuff around.
Yeah, you don't want to keep bad stuff.
It could be counterproductive potentially. And that's just more for like the audience, you know, like, exactly. You always need to be able to size these equations. So you could absolutely reduce breakdown, but that might get you an undesirable result.
What's probably more likely to happen when your hypertrophy is you get an increase in protein synthesis, and maybe the increase in protein synthesis is greater than the increase in breakdown, and then you get bigger. Right. Yeah. Okay.
Yeah,
cool.
Actually, when you eat. Exactly.
Now, the other thing I guess I wondered about was, I guess it's too early to know, but you know, if you strength train and then 20 years later, you know, and then you stop, and then 20 years later you do it again, and there's this muscle memory. And then if you endurance train 20 years later, you do it again. Do we know which is more likely to have muscle memory, you know, strength versus endurance? And also, I guess we touched on it earlier, how long, you know, it might last. So if you stop for 20 years, 30 years, 5 years, 6 months.
Yeah. So I think to answer the endurance versus the resistance, I'll speculate. The studies that have looked at the memory from endurance training versus the memory from his resistance training, I think the studies that have shown, looked at like memory, either at like the transcriptional level or even maybe at the epigenetic level, don't show it to be as prevalent as what you get with resistance training. Now, I will admit that my power model, is a combination. And so, but I'm based on inferring from other literature would think that it's perhaps more the consequence of the hypertrophy component as it is from the endurance component. At least that's my sort of leaning at the moment. So I think maybe the memory component could be more linked to a hypertrophic sort of stimulus potentially. And as far as how long, which is, I mean, a very relevant question. And the answer is, I'm not sure because no one's done like a time course in humans, but I can say that at least back to our closing the loop on our conversation, as far as the, you know, the lifespan of a mouse, you know, when we detrain a mouse for 12 weeks, that's like a long time in the life of a mouse.
Yes.
And so still see some of these things persisting. And so, yeah, I'm looking at the study design of the muscle memory study, and we detrained our mice for 12 weeks and then retrained them.
Mm-hmm.
It was 12 weeks. And so that's a pretty long time in the lifespan of a mouse. Now, how that relates to a human being, I don't know. And I think that comes back to those anecdotes that maybe former athletes say, where it's like, I was an athlete in college and then I stopped and I got into the working world and I didn't, you know, lift weights forever, but then I got back in the gym and it's like, you know, second nature and the muscle came back.
Exactly.
So I don't know. That's anecdote. So take that for what it's worth.
I guess you've got a million studies to do, but it would be nice if you did a running wheel without the weighted. Because again, I'm showing my endurance bias here. And just see if they do have that muscle memory. Because part of me thought, well, hang on, maybe it's more likely to be endurance because the slow fibers didn't go back. You know what I mean? The fast fibers did.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah. No, it's a fair question. I've been told many times before, why didn't you have a non-weighted wheel? I was like, because I only have
No. I think it's good. And you wouldn't have got, if you did a non-weighted wheel, maybe and it only really happens with weight training, you may have missed it, right? So I think it's great. Now, I just realized the other thing. So when we talk about these, you know, just to explain more about the lifespan of a rodent versus a human. So, because we're often doing developmental stuff. So the rats, for example, so give people an idea, the rats would wean at 3.5 weeks. Okay. Mm-hmm. So humans do not wean at 3.5 weeks, 6 months or something. So just to give people an idea of the difference. And their total lifespan is about 2 years or something, which is obviously very short. So just again, backing that up. Now, I wonder, the other thing, I guess, is how much training do you need to then get the muscle memory effects. So obviously if you just did one bout, you wouldn't expect, you know, that the, even if you get epigenetic markers, you probably think they'd wear off, you know. So again, it's like the more you do, the more likely you're going to get the muscle memory, I guess.
That would be my inclination. But I mean, even at, I'm not going to say an acute bout of exercise is enough to see this long-lasting change, but an acute bout of exercise can change epigenetic marks. It does.
Absolutely.
We think. And so mm-hmm. evidence for that. And so, yeah, I mean, how many it takes to like lock in, I guess, the epigenetic change, if you know, there is a long-lasting one, how long it takes to lock it in? I don't know. It's a good question. I mean, at least in our study, obviously, with the power training, they were training a lot. You know, we said that 8 to 12 kilometers.
Yeah, a lot.
But, you know, human studies that have done this have been much more reasonable, like, you know, three mm-hmm. days a week of resistance training, you know, three sets of 10 type of stuff. And, you know, they still see some of these responses. So you can scale it back relatively pretty significantly and still see some of these responses. But as far as like, you know, would 2 weeks of 5 minutes a day of HIIT be enough, like high intensity interval training or something like that? I don't know. People haven't done those studies yet that I'm aware of. So, yeah, it's interesting.
The other thing that made things complicated is specificity, because, you know, we know if you do weight training versus training, it's very specific. So if you did like isometric, so where your muscle's not changing length, I think it's been found, I know it had been found, I don't know if it's been backed up later on, but you only get strength gains in sort of like 10 degrees either side of that. Like you don't get it throughout the full range. So I'm just thinking, you know, and then more specific stuff like eccentric contractions versus concentric contractions and things like that, you tend to get specific adaptations.
Yep.
And it's hard to think how that would fit, you know what I mean? Like you wouldn't, how would you pick that up in the muscle fiber to then go, oh, I did concentric training, which is muscle shortening. And then 10 years later, I did eccentric training. Do I get muscle memory? You know what I mean?
Yeah, that would be exceedingly difficult. Yeah, I don't know. Yeah. I have no idea.
That's pretty cool to think about, though. I wasn't expecting you to know the answer to that one, but just I think it's just an extra layer of complexity. All right, so what are we doing here? I just went and looked at my notes. I think we've got through quite a lot. It's been great, actually. I've enjoyed it. Do you have any thoughts, other stuff we haven't talked about? I had this in my notes, and you actually, nature or nurture, or nature and nurture. Now, I reckon that is very cool. So talking about, so nature is sort of your genetics, nurture is your epigenetics, you know, in the way that we've been talking. Because I always thought, because the best journal in the world is called Nature. Yeah. And then you talk about, everyone always says, is it nature or nurture? I reckon a great journal would be Nature and Nurture. So it's genetics and
counterpoint, just nurture, and then maybe nature and nurture.
So anyway, I thought that was kind of fun. Okay, so we covered everything. So another thing I was going to mention, I guess the epigenetics thing is a classic, is the Dutch famine. So if people want to think about something you could maybe relate to more, so during the Second World War, Dutch famine, you know, the Dutch weren't able to get enough food in. And then you see the epigenetics, because you see across time that the generations, several generations on, are still affected by that insufficient food way back then. So it's just another example I had. Okay, I'll let you answer now. Have we covered everything that we wanted to cover, do you think?
I think mostly, yeah. I think we covered an awful lot of ground. We didn't talk too much about, you know, satellite cells and stuff, but I feel like that's a whole other podcast, I sort of think. And so, and you know what? When Chris Fry comes on, you should ask him, because he would be the perfect guy to chat about that with. So I can pass that one off to Chris. Okay.
All right. So now, we did have one you had, because I like to ask about effect of age, effects of sex differences and things. You did have one, I think, effects of age on some of this, or?
Effects of age. Well, as far as muscle memory, I mean, I know that there was a study that was done where they tried to look at this muscle memory idea in young versus age, and there was a very small sample size. But they had folks train and retrain young and old, and found that at least when you're older, is that the proper thing to say? If you're
an age challenged person,
a person of an older age,
wise
as a person who studies age. Mm-hmm. Know more about the terminology.
No,
But
it's hard.
but
It
yeah,
things change all the time, as you know.
but yeah, a person that's older in age would still have the ability to, well, get adaptations from the training initially, but also have a muscle memory effect. And it seems like whether you're younger or older, there's still this like sort of amplified response to the retraining. And so in that sense, it seems like it could be, you know, a conserved thing across the lifespan. But again, it's like going back to the question of what the initial training was, and then how long
How
you
long?
waited, was it, you know, 2 months or 20 years? Like, these are all very, very open-ended questions. We may not even know the answer.
No, I
So,
guess no one's looked at sex differences. So what did you have both sexes of mice or, because again, you got a double everything, but or did you have males or?
So for most of the studies for our exercise training, DT training stuff, we use females because they tend to run better and run more. They tend to be more consistent with their running. And so it's more of a practical consideration. The females just take to it better and perform better. For the epigenetic studies I'm talking about, at least the one where we looked at DNA methylation and the myonuclei and isolated the myonuclei and things like that, we used male mice because I had used all my female mice for other studies. And so I was left with the
Okay.
male. Well, we're going to run it with the males. And we did. And they still ran. They ran less than the females. But as far as like, have we looked at sex differences between them? No, we haven't. To be determined.
Okay, great. All right. Well, this has been great. But while I've got you, I can't help noticing you had in your CV and things some of these articles where you sort of lay type articles you've had. And I couldn't help, one jumped out at me, busting muscle myths paper. So just why we've got you, because I know we could get you for a whole satellite cell thing as well, but I'm interested about this. We address common misconceptions, including the go big or go home, and if you don't use it, you lose it approaches. Okay. So if you don't use it, you lose it. I guess you're saying it's part of the muscle memory side, yeah. But I guess
Muscle
you'd
memory.
still agree that if you don't use it, I guess you'd still agree that if you don't use it, you'll lose it to some extent, but
Yeah,
it's
you
just,
do,
yeah.
but you might get it back faster. Yeah, so that was sort of the message there. Yeah, of course, yeah. Well, if you're a soleus of a mouse, maybe you don't lose it. I don't know,
Yeah, exactly.
but
But
yeah, but that paper was, you know, just something fun that me
yeah,
and
I
a
get
couple of
it
my
now. I get it now. That, like, yep.
authors there, the other ones, Dr. Jimmy Bagley and Dr. Andy Galpin, they did a really cool study on nature versus nurture, where they had like it was a twin study where they had identical twins. One was a lifelong triathlete, and the other one was like a truck driver, like never exercised at all,
Okay.
but they were genetically identical. And they were
Yes.
like a really interesting study and show like how radically different their fiber type was, and like, you know, the genetic determinant fiber type versus how much you can
Okay.
swing it on exercise, and really
Cool.
interesting. So yeah, you're saying nature versus nurture. It makes me
There
think
you
that
go.
that was just such a striking example of how powerful exercise is. You know, the phenotype between those
Absolutely.
two guys is radically different. It's a published study. It was published a couple of years ago.
Oh,
So
cool.
it's very, very, very cool. So,
And the
yeah.
go big or go home, I guess. What were you thinking there, I guess?
Oh, that was you know, kind of the Stu Phillips sort of message that, you know, you don't necessarily have to lift super,
Exactly.
super time to put on muscle
Exactly.
mass. And
Exactly.
so
So these are good because you don't want to be scaring people off. Like, oh, you know, it's not worth going to the gym unless I just smash myself every day and whatever, which is exactly what we don't want people to be thinking, because then they just get sore and they give up.
true. Yep.
All right. Now, what I do have is something I threw sent to you beforehand was part of the idea of inside exercise is because we want people to get their information from the experts rather than from influencers. And I like asking people more recently, is there something, you know, this is your chance to sort of take on these influencers that are sort of peddling misinformation. And now I know you said you don't really, you know, follow influencers, which is probably wise, but although someone said I'm becoming an influencer, and it's like, well, no, I'm not, because, okay, let me, in case people are wondering about this, even if this podcast got to 1 million views, I still wouldn't consider myself an influencer because I'm not giving my own opinion. You know, obviously it comes out here and there, but I'm not like going off and like a lot of podcasters and just rattling on about stuff that I'm not an expert in. I tend to get my information from experts, and I try and get people to get their information from the experts, and I don't like give my own theories at the end or whatever. So I'd like to think I'm not an influencer. But What you know, is there something that cheeses you off that that you hear bandied around?
Sure. And yeah, like I reiterate, I don't really follow influencers on the fitness realm per se. So, but I will say it makes me just reflect on the question of what is an expert? Because I've thought about this quite a bit. And it's like, a couple people that I follow, you know, and have interesting content, this and that. But, you know, like just because someone can read a research paper and interpret it doesn't make them an expert. You know, a lot of people... No. They make a whole shtick out of, you know, what's evidence-based. We're evidence-based. We read the literature, this and that. And that's wonderful. Evidence-based is great. But you know, just because you can read a paper and interpret it better than somebody who doesn't read the literature doesn't make them an expert in that. You know, like I think about what makes anybody on this podcast an expert, the fact that they know the field, and that involves reading, of course. You have to read the papers. But the other part of it is being able to identify when a study is appropriate or good or bad, or whether the methods were done correctly. Because I mean, you can have this wonderful, seemingly wonderful study that has all these amazing findings, but if all the methods were done poorly and you can mm-hmm. identify that, then the study's not worth very much. And I think that's a lot of times where an influencer will go astray. They'll see a study come out, they don't know anything about the authors or the journal or the methods because they've never done any sort of mm-hmm. research themselves. And then they say, this is the state of the literature. And it's like, well, that's the state of one study. And it was one study that was exactly. conducted poorly. So I'm not so sure that that's a good message.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. You're living and breathing this stuff for like, you know, 10 years, 20 years, whatever. You can't just read a few papers. And that's the thing that gets, because literally people will say to me, why don't you, you know, just take a few days, read up in an area and then do a podcast and just talk about the area. And it's like, well, because I'm not going to be an expert. Oh yeah, but you'll know more than 99% of the audience. Sure. But sure. Why don't I just interview the expert? And I won't name names, but there's all these huge podcasters and people that they just, I don't get how they do it. So there's one guy in particular, you know, he's a, whatever he is. He talks, you know, sure, okay, you've got your own area, but you can't talk about 20 different areas. But these people are just massive, massive.
The devil's anyway. In the details, like as with anything, you know, and I, me and any other person that studies the things I study knows how, has a sense of how methods should be conducted and how assays should be done. And yet all these different, just so many experimental considerations for anybody that's an expert in an area. And we're always thinking about these things and there's no way an influencer can know the things. They just can't. And so not to discount what they're trying to do, I think it can be a net positive, but sometimes it isn't.
Well, they get things wrong. It's a problem.
Yeah.
And they're often trying to flog supplements as well. I can't help myself. Okay. So that's great. Now, is there anything else, because then you'll get into satellite sales. I was going to say, is there other stuff you're working on that you're excited about? But I think we want to wrap that up because I think it's clear that you would like to talk about stuff like that. Now, all right. So how about we finish up with some takeaway messages. So, you know, when you give a talk, you think, oh, there's two or three things I want people to take away from this. Some takeaway messages to wrap up.
Sure. You know, it's important to consider, you know, the experimental design of a mouse versus a human and the different things that go into a human study versus a mouse study and the different considerations. It's always important to view what you're listening to or what you're reading within that light. In the context of muscle memory, you know, there's evidence to suggest that it could be related to the number of myonuclei that you gain and have upon retraining, but it could also be related to a variety of other factors. It could be related to epigenetics or microRNAs or things that we haven't even measured. But I think the idea that if you were to detrain and take some time off and then start training again, there's a chance that it might come back a little easier the second time. And there could be a variety of reasons for why that is. And so, and that's kind of the area that we're working on. We're interested in and knowing more about. And so I think, that probably captures the high points of our talk. So, I don't know.
And the evidence is pretty clear that the muscle, because I have to admit, when I first looked at this area, I thought, well, is that really a thing or not? But so the evidence, even though there hasn't been a whole bunch done, you think it's pretty clear, because I know you've done mice, but even in humans as well, that muscle memory is a thing. So if you do exercise training, especially we know more about strength training, then, I don't know, 6 months, 2 years, 10 years later, you do it again, it is likely you will take to it quicker and get bigger or better quicker And it will be in the muscle. It's not just the motor learning. It's not just the fact you know what you're doing.
And I'll say that the motor learning and stuff doesn't contribute. It probably does. But, you know, yeah, we think that that's probably the case. And I mean, I don't think that gives you license to, okay, I used to lift 175 pounds on the bench. I'm just going to jump right back into that. You know, like, not a good idea. You know, like, you probably want to have some common sense here. But, you know, if you follow an appropriate prescription, yeah, there's a decent chance that you might, you know, that muscle might come back a little bit quicker. You might get stronger a little faster. But also, you know, just the idea that, yeah, if you have to take time off, it's not a death sentence, you know, like you can get back into it and you can still have benefits and maybe they'll even be come back faster that second time potentially. And that's great, you know? And so, you know, don't give up.
Actually, I was just about to finish. Now I often do this. I need to take away messages and I have something else. Just thinking, what about the health benefits? You know, so we often, you know, we talk about the hypertrophy and all that, but we know that strength training, endurance training, both of them improve, you know, your glucose regulation and all sorts of health benefits, blood pressure and things like that. Do we know if they stick around a bit?
That's a great question. I don't know, because I've been so in the muscle and so in the cell that I'm about the more important things. So that's a good, at least with resistance training. I don't know. I haven't looked into that. That's a good question.
It'd be interesting to see if they,
I would think that with the detrain from like aerobic training, some of that would last a little while, but I don't know how long. I don't know. Good question. Good question, Glenn.
Well, and then I guess, I mean, you are going to lose some of those health benefits, but whether they come back quicker as well, you know, so maybe you get the drop in your blood pressure and improvement in your glucose tolerance and all that. Maybe that comes back quicker as well.
So they haven't already.
health, not just muscle, but whole body health, memory or something. Okay. All right. Well, thanks again for coming on. So you're definitely a rising star. And one thing is, you know, you think, oh, maybe they won't know their stuff as much as someone who's been around for 20, 30 years. So you obviously know your stuff really well. And I think I was actually thinking that you're a good example of how I couldn't just go and you know, to tie it in what we said before. I could spend a week, 2 weeks, 3 weeks reading up on this stuff. And there's no way I could do what you did, right? So that's the whole idea. You've got to interview the experts. Okay.
Well, I appreciate the opportunity to be here. It's a huge, very flattering, because your podcast has had like juggernauts in the field, and it's really cool to be counted among them now. So it's really flattering for me. So thank you for the honor. And I hope that this is beneficial to people.
I'm sure it will be.
We'll listen. So.
Okay. Well, good on you, mate. See ya. See you around. Bye-bye.
Take care.
Yeah. Bye. I hope you enjoyed this podcast. Please like, subscribe, pass it on to your friends and colleagues. Check out the other podcasts. Thanks again.